I shall leave you as you left me.
As you left me. What?
Marooned for all eternity in the center of a dead planet. Buried alive.
That woman is fired because that's not the clip that's supposed to play. What's going on here? What's going on? This is the clip.
Jean-Luc, Shorty Specs, mysteries on the holodeck, asteroids, triple droids, telepathic betazoids, transporter, deadly claw, visitor from L.A. Law, photons, no Kirk, captain has gone berserk, shuttlecraft, Consul Troy, Dr. Crusher's little boy, Klingon rights, parasites, new heights, phaser fights, Data's head, Tasha's dead, Riker's hanging by a thread, celebration, transformations, everyone to battle
stations. The next generation on your favorite station. We can start the series, but when we are gone, it'll feel beyond. We can start the series. It's the next generation on your favorite station. We can start the series.
You know, this is a live show, and when you do a live show, things like this happen. Right? Weird. So not only did the intro not play, but it was the wrong intro. That was our intro before we had the new intro. We currently God, I don't know. Let's just hope the rest of the show goes better. Anyways, welcome to Trek Talkin'. It is Thursday, February 29th, 2024. And this is episode 582. Hard to believe. I'm your most excellent host, Uncle Jim, and I would like to introduce to you my incredible Trexperts, and we're going to talk out with Charles. Charles is out in Las Vegas. How you doing tonight, Charles?
I'm doing good. As we had our crosstalk, it's like the weather's crazy as usual. Yep, it's calm here. And nice 60s, but it'll be dropping to 50s over the weekend with a lot of wind. And that'll be heading Jim's way as we go.
Yeah, it's been pretty windy here in Vermont, but we can deal with it. And we're gonna flip all the way over to Portland. And unfortunately, I don't have my trifecta with us. We only have a double play, a 5-4-3 double. And we'll start off with our very own Eric. How you doing tonight, Eric?
You know, I'm doing pretty good, guys. I was extremely satisfied with this timeline up until now, but now I kind of feel like I need a temporal incursion to go back and replay that intro. I don't know.
Isn't that weird? I don't
know. They're giving Anorax a call.
Absolutely. Oh, boy. And we also have with us our very own Paul the Toy Guy. How you doing tonight, Paul?
Hello, Uncle Jim. I'm doing well. How are you?
No one listens when I do, so I don't bother.
Doing okay, man. It's been a long, crazy week. I'm so glad it's almost over, and it should be fun.
It is. It's Friday's Eve. If you take a deep, deep breath, yep, that's it. You can catch a whiff of Friday. It's like right around the corner from you. It's closer than you think, actually.
Oh, God, I hope that's true.
It is. It's going to, I promise you. I promise you that it's on its way. It will be here sooner than you think. And then we'll be celebrating Saturday and Sunday and Monday. And we have Tuesday off here up in Vermont because it's town meeting day. So we need to go out.
Town meeting day.
Wow.
Yeah,
cool.
It's to go out and vote.
Do you have to go and do a barn raising after that or anything like that? Or is there like butter to be churned? Or what?
Get the cows first and then we go out.
Okay.
And do that.
Yeah, it sounds very, very, very quaint. I love it. Town meeting day.
Town meeting.
I hear Elmer's going down to the convenience store and looking to buy some more coat hangers.
Now, do other places have town meetings, or is this just some rustic Vermont thing? Like, did they do it in Oregon?
I don't think they, well, even in a big city, so I don't know. I mean, it's possible that small towns do, but I don't know, man. Not that I'm hip to, but who knows?
Do they have town meetings in Las Vegas?
No town meetings. We do celebrate the state birthday, but no town meetings.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, Las Vegas
wow.
has like town orgies. I mean, let's screw it. No town meeting. Come on, what are you talking about?
Oh boy. Town meeting day is Tuesday, so the state shuts down, and we get to go to the town meeting and complain.
Every
about
month, or is this every week? You get it every
no,
week.
No, one day a year, right?
Well,
one day a year.
Yeah,
so if it's every week, that's the greatest scam ever, man. I mean, we got to start getting town meetings here, if that's true.
No,
well, you know, I remember Boston's got, like, Patriots Day, which is the weirdest holiday, too. So that, I think it's just a Northeast thing. You have weird holidays up there.
And do Patriots
because
Day.
Boston has a lot of drinking holidays, that's why.
Well, that is also true.
Yes, yes. So, anyways, guys, we're going to be talking about a Voyager episode, Year of Hell. Our phone number here is 646-668-2433. If you would like to call and share your opinions on the Voyager episode of Year of Hell, please give us a call and we'll get you on the line. But before we go too far, we need to start off the show with some sad news because we lost Kenneth Mitchell. I believe it was Tuesday. I think it was on Tuesday. For those of you who don't know, Kenneth Mitchell had ALS. And they actually wrote a special character for him in Discovery Season 4. He played Aurelio, and they actually wrote the character in a wheelchair so that he could play the role. It's a tragic story. It's terrible, and we're going to remember him right now. I have the obituary here that I want to read to you guys. We are deeply saddened to report the passing of Kenneth Mitchell, who played the Klingons Coleshaw, and Tenevic, as well as Aurelio on Star Trek Discovery. In addition, he voiced several voice characters in an episode of Star Trek Lower Decks. Mitchell passed away at age 49 on February 24, 2024. Born November 25, 1974, in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, Mitchell appeared in multiple films and television shows, including roles such as the father of the superhero Carol Danvers in Captain Marvel, Olympic Hopeful, and Miracle. Other roles include turns on Jericho, The Astronaut's Wife's Club, Ghost Whisperer, and Slipped at Birth. As Cole, Mitchell hoped to bring a new perspective on Klingon culture to fans through his turn on Discovery. Whether someone is good or bad is all about perspective, and it's about understanding that culture. You'll get to know the Klingons on our show, and then people can decide if we really are the villains, Mitchell said. Mitchell is survived by his wife, Susan May Pratt, and their two children. He requested that any gifts be directed towards amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS research, in support of his children, Lila and Caleb. And I wanted to play a little something for Kenneth Mitchell.
Okay, now we're going.
This is the Klingon Warrior Anthem. I played General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and this is how it goes. Oi, Kaelas, Ubron, Oi, Pusfe, Ubron, Yakba, Makba, Jeju, Semwaktu, Meuva, Masho,
And I was shocked when I heard the news, and I mean I knew that he wasn't doing well, but I didn't think it was going to be that quick. And I think that Kenneth Mitchell will be missed. I think he was a hero, and I think the example that he set for everybody is he's a true hero in every sense of the word. So Ken Mitchell will definitely be missed. Anybody want to say anything?
Well, I was just going to say, I thought it was great that I read the other day that they did a special thing for him on the Star Trek cruise also to honor him, which I thought was kind of a cool thing. There's actually a video online that you can watch that that shows some stuff from that. But, man, that guy came in and made a big impact in Star Trek in a relatively short amount of time. And I think it was his portrayal. It was his ability to actually act through what I think some actors found to be really tough to act through, that Klingon makeup from Discovery, and somehow he managed to do it. So, and honestly, when he's Cole, like, he kind of scares the crap out of you when he comes on screen, which I think is what a Klingon is supposed to do. So that tells me this man had some talent, and it's too bad that we lost him so early. But Lou Gehrig's disease is no joke, man, and we still don't have a cure for it. So give, if you can, to organizations that are doing research to try and figure out how to beat this thing.
Yeah, I agree. I think that he was a great Klingon. I thought he played Tenetic great when he gives Captain Pike the time crystal. And I think it was great that they wrote Aurelio for him. And we actually got a character on Star Trek in a wheelchair. And a lot of fans were like, they don't have wheelchairs on Star Trek, but you know, I think it was great that they did that for him, and my condolences go out to his family. So, all right. So I thought that we definitely should start off the show by remembering Kenneth Mitchell. You guys can head over to our Facebook page, and at the top of our Facebook page, you will see a pinned little thing saying, hey, where are you guys listening from? And all you got to do is drop us a line. Leave me lots of emojis, because I read a lot of stuff, and the emojis will get my attention, and you'll have a better chance of being chosen as for a fan shout out. So, Eric, you want to start us off with our fan shout outs for this week?
Yeah, I sure do. Our very first fan shout out this week goes out to top fan David L. Brown, who's saying hello to us from Glasgow, Scotland. And top fan status means that David interacts with us a ton on our Facebook page. And we really appreciate that. We appreciate the feedback. We appreciate the likes. Jim appreciates the emojis, et cetera. So live long and prosper to you, David L. Brown. And thanks for carrying our flag over there in Glasgow. We appreciate it. Also saying hello this week to Glenn Hastings, who's saying hello to us from the Philippines. Glenn says, I try to introduce my Filipino friends to all Trek, but their resistance is not futile. Oh, Glenn, keep working on them. Keep working on them. You just got to find that special moment, that special episode, and you'll hook them. You just got to keep at it. Thanks so much for saying hello to us way over there in the Philippines. We appreciate that. Also saying hello this week to Andrea Recupero, who's saying hello to us from Patagonia in Argentina, way down south from here. Andrea, that looks like a really cool area down there. Argentina makes some of my favorite wines on the planet, and I'm sure they're even better when you're there sipping on them, taking in the views from those beautiful mountains. Thank you so much for saying hello to us, and we really appreciate your support all the way down there in South America. Thank you so much. And last on my list, we're saying hello this week to Anka Biernat, who's saying hello to us from Lorle, Germany. Lots of supporters for the podcast over there in Deutschland. And Anka, we appreciate your support as well. Charles, passing out that shout-out megaphone over to you, sir.
Oh, thank you, Eric. That start off. Sorry. So welcome to Christopher Lee from Denver, Colorado. How's the weather over there, up there in Denver? Not too snowy, I hope. Welcome to Phil Koa from Knoxville, Tennessee. Top fan, Dennis Wade from Ohio. Welcome, Dennis. And welcome from the home state of James T. Kirk, Iowa. Welcome, Dave Henry. Dave's not here. Welcome, Anna Marie Bergren from Northern Michigan. Welcome, Kelly L. Gulliquixen Madison, up in the far north, upper Midwest state of North Dakota. We are less than 100 miles south of the U.S.-Canadian border, close to Manitoba, heading up towards Chris's territory. Top fan, welcome top fan Ralph Hubbard from West Virginia. And a final welcome to Lenny Joyner from Ackworth, Georgia. And with all that, Paul, who's on your list?
Thanks, Charles. Appreciate it. Well, let's just bop on out of the United States for a little while, and let's head on over to Orléans, France, and our good friend Phil Superon. Now, Phil is not just our good friend. Phil is a top fan and is lucky enough to live in Orléans, of course. That's a city on the banks of the Loire River in north-central France, and very, very famous, as a lot of folks would know, from the 15th century, where Joan of Arc famously saved the city from a siege by the English, a very heroic bit of historical heroism there. So a wonderful place to live with great history all around. So it's great to hear from you, Phil, and all the best, my friend, and thanks for being a fan of Star Trek and of this show. Changing continents, we're going to go to Johannesburg, South Africa, and say hello to our friend Arula Jans van Rensburg, who is also a massive Star Trek fan. So we're seeing fans all across the globe. We're just spinning the compass needle wildly, leaping from one continent to the other, and we're going to say hello to our friend Mariska van Nijendaal from the Netherlands, Den Helder in the Netherlands, flag flying proudly. And then take your frequent flyer miles, because you got about an 18-hour flight, but we're going to go down to Australia, and we're going to visit Queensland there, where the flag is unfurled by our friend Sharon Guillard there. Queensland is a pretty amazing state. It's more on the northeastern coastal area of Australia. Very, very famous for being very, very close to the world's largest coral reef system, the Great Barrier Reef. Pretty amazing. Some of the best surfing and scuba diving on the planet. Might want to bring a shark cage, though. There's some big pork or great whites swimming around there. You want to be careful of those boys. But pretty amazing. All kinds of wildlife in Queensland. It's an amazing part of the planet. It is amazing to see that all of that diverse territory in the Netherlands, South Africa, France, Australia, the Star Trek fans everywhere on the planet. And we have far more in common than we do apart, which I just love. So let's see who Jim's got on his list here today.
All right. We'd like to say thank you to top fan Barbara Montesero, who's listening to us in New York, U.S. of A. And those tribbles, they get into everything, don't they? They worse than gremlins.
I don't know what's the problem there.
I want to say thank you to Martha Jones, who's listening to us in Tennessee, U.S. of A. That's pretty cool. We want to say thank you to Anthony Kevin Johnson, who's listening to us in Forest Park, Illinois. And last, but definitely not least, we're going to go all the way back to Melbourne, Australia. Paul just came from there. And we're going to say thank you to top fan Garth Davey. And that wraps up our fan shout-outs. If you guys would like to be featured in a future fan shout-out, head over to our Facebook page and just drop us a line. We would love to hear from you. All right, guys, now it's time to get right down to it. We had posted on our Facebook page and asked you guys to score the Voyager, the two-part Voyager episode, Year of Hell, which was episode 8 and 9 of season 4. And we collected your scores. And Eric, what did our Facebook fans have to say about Year of Hell?
Well, Michael Scott Martin said, this is some of the best Voyager, but it would have been even better if they had carried the storyline out 6 or 8 episodes. As is, I give it an 8.5 now. Pay attention to this refrain, people. Top fan Derek J. Molichek said 10. Should have been bigger, though. Big screen feature at least. Woo! Top fan Trent Webb said 10! Exclamation point. If they had made it a longer arc, say 6 episodes, I'd give it an 11. Great storytelling. Ronald Gibson said, I'll give it a 10. Oh, wait. Change in the timeline. That 10 rating never actually happened. So I'll give it a 7.7. Carmen Delete. That was pretty clever. Carmen DeLito, I can't imagine a better episode. Someone can, but not me. So 9.9, also a great comment. Ted Maloney gave it a 10. Great concept, well executed, and terrific character study. The actor playing the villain was an excellent choice. He pulled it off. Coach got pulled into thinking it could work, and Paris kept struggling to yank him back. Also, in classic Star Trek fashion, makes one reflect on how we tinker with nature, thinking we can fix it with just one more technological change instead of working with it. Thanks, Ted. Jeff Akers gave it a 9.5. Half a point taken off for calling the Uber baddie Anorax. My guess is that's another Star Trek reference. Jonathan Searchy gave it a 8. Could have used a few more episodes to show the year. Ah, heard that before. Tom Fan, Ashley Williams, said 10, one of my favorites of Voyager, in the top 5 if you treat all the two-parters as a single episode. And Top Fan Robin McCann said 10. I think Voyager did a hell of a job taking down the man who wanted to remake the entire universe. That, my friends, gives us a fan score for Year of Hell of 9.6. Pretty impressive. And you know what that music means. It's once again time to put on your thinking caps and join us for Star Trek Trivia Time with Uncle Jim.
All right, guys, you ready? I'm going to lob some softballs at you. We'll see if you guys can hit them. Pretty sure you can. Eric, we don't have... All right, we'll start off with Eric. You ready for the first question?
Yeah, sure, man. I'm ready. I know this episode well, so we'll see.
Okay. Voyager makes an improvement to the ship by adding what?
Oh, this is the episode where they add the astrometrics lab, which becomes one of Seven's kind of favorite joints to hang out for the rest of the series.
Yes, absolutely. Charles, you ready for one?
Yep.
All right. Anorax, the Kremlin commander, keeps a clear pyramid-shaped protective case in his office. What does the case contain?
Oh.
Well, for most of the episode, it contained a lock of hair from his wife. But I think by the end of the episode, it contained a lot of air.
Yeah.
I'm glad.
Well said, Charles. Well said.
I think you're on to something there. I think, it was just full of hot air. Think of that, but you're absolutely right. Hot air.
That's like bonus points. Charles answered the question, and then he answered the question a second time. That was good.
That's the bonus question. All right. Paul, you ready?
Hit me.
All right. While Kim and Taurus are trapped in a turbo lift, they challenge each other to some trivia. Kim gives Taurus some clues and asks her the name of the movie and the male lead. What were the correct answers?
Well, Uncle Jim, you're talking about...
Something's wrong with your sound system.
Wow. You really are hung up on your sound clips, dude. I'll tell you what. It's like a rhythm killer. You're talking about the great Alfred Hitchcock picture, To Catch a Thief, okay, with the inimitable Cary Grant and, of course, Grace Kelly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's right, George and Gracie, the humpback whales, right? That was a different movie. I'm sorry.
Different.
Not even. Yeah.
Different time.
Sorry, good buddy. That would be a big no.
All right.
But there's a funny kind of mix up between Cary Grant and Clark Gable that they kind of go back and forth a bit about, which is kind of funny in the episode.
Yeah. Good stuff.
So, David, ready for a question?
Nope.
He's not.
Dave's not here.
All right. Well, I'll throw it out and we'll see who can answer. Well, this will be a free for all. It's the big bonus question. Are you ready? When Kim and Taurus are trapped in the turbo lift, who rescues them?
We've got to
give our fans at home an opportunity to come up with the question before we give them the answer. Who's got the answer?
That would be 7 of 9.
Wasn't that 7, 8, 9?
Yeah. Fun will now.
Seven, eight. Yep. 7 of 9. That's right. Mm-hmm. Okay, Eric, you ready?
Oh, sure.
Yep, this one's for you. Tom Paris sets up transverse bulkheads using force fields. While explaining how they should work to Captain Janeway, what ship does he reference?
Yeah, that's actually pretty funny because Janeway says something like, wait, didn't that ship sink? Tom Paris was, of course, talking about the Titanic.
That's right. He was talking about the Titanic, which I thought was a great reference, actually. Charles, you ready to take a spin?
Yep.
All right. During an attempt to repair the ventilation system, Captain Janeway and Ensign Kim breathe in toxic gases. What does Janeway tell the doctor to inject her with to help her breathe?
Oh, my.
What do you think?
She needs some trioxin and a cup of coffee.
Yep, black coffee. Black coffee. All right. Paul. You ready? You got your thinking cap on?
I do, I think.
All right. Voyager, with heavy damage, runs into a micro-meteor shower. With the engines offline, someone must go to deflector control to get the deflectors working. Who goes? It's not Captain Kirk on
Tuesday. I'm just waiting for that really, really long echo of the snare drum to begin, right? It seems to frickin' go on forever.
The reverb of the room is nice.
Yeah, I'm happy to answer without it. That would be the person who, in this two-parter, spends as much time as humanly possible with their uniform jacket off so you can see their rippling biceps beneath that wife beater that she's wearing, because it's like she's been to the gym and she's all sweaty and, like, you know, hardcore for, like, pretty much this entire two-parter. That would be Captain Janeway.
That's right, Captain Janeway, it is. And David isn't here, so I guess we'll throw this one out there. In the following quote, Tuvok says, what is the missing word? Blank is hardly a life-threatening activity.
Masturbation.
Ah, there you go. Well, what do you think, Eric?
Oh, I think Paul's got this one. I think.
Yeah, I think so, right? Come on.
That's what it was. Yeah. No, I mean, it is kind of a funny scene because he's sitting there looking at himself in the mirror while he's blind because he's shaving.
With a straight edge razor, which he says is not a life threatening.
Well, that's because, I mean, if you're Vulcan, you're all in, man. You're shaving with you probably would shave with a Lyrpa if they let you, right?
That's true. That's very true. That's very true. And I have the bonus question, which is open to anybody. And this is a tough one. So you're going to have to really think long and hard to answer this one. How does Captain Janeway destroy the Kremen ship? Tough question.
Nope.
Well,
tell me you have a sound bite. Tell me you have a worse sound bite for this.
Tribble.
Well, she doesn't say prepare for ramming speed, but basically she says prepare for ramming speed, and that's exactly what she does because she's a freaking badass in this whole episode.
And she runs right into it. Yep.
Yep.
That's exactly right. All right, guys, so I hope you enjoyed our Star Trek trivia. I had some fun putting it together. And now it's time for cadet training with Sharp. Okay, Charles, the microphone is yours.
All right. Well, only a couple of them came into mind with this one because I'm thinking about time. And a couple of good time episodes from Next Generation. We got season 2, episode 13, when they had Time Squared. And then again in TNG, another good time one, especially how what you do can affect things is cause and effect. And then
yep.
I'm getting a third one. I don't remember. Parallels. Was that also TNG?
Yeah, that's Next Generation, yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Parallels also from season seven, episode 11. I know there's
a couple of them
out there, but thanks. That's a good one. That's another one that works in well.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a good one. All right, guys. Are we ready to talk about the year of hell?
Woohoo.
Who wants to start us off? Who wants to take the engine? Take the bull by the horns and drive this bad boy home. Who wants to get started?
I think I'd like to nominate Eric because Eric has had to break Anchorman a bunch in the last couple of months. So I think that you should take point, buddy.
Sweet, man. Thanks. So this Year of Hell was my suggestion for us to review. It is, I think it's safe to say, widely considered to be one of the best episodes of Voyager. And I think that our fans actually pointed out a lot of reasons that that's true. There's some great character moments here. There's like Voyager blowing up. The episode has humor. It has new races. It has time travel. It has themes of regret. I personally think Anorax is like one of the coolest villains that we see in Voyager because he doesn't... he's not a mustache-twirling villain, you know? He's kind of got this, I don't know if it's goodness, but he kind of has this, like, good intention within him, and he's not necessarily a rude guy. Even when you compare him to the other Krennan throughout the episode, he's always sort of polite. And, yes, he's trying to get people to do his bidding in some respects.
Bidding.
But I appreciate him as a character, and I think Kurtwood Smith just absolutely knocked it out of the park with his performance. It's very complex. You see in his facial expressions the complexities of thought that Anorax is going through. But he also is kind of like a megalomaniac, right? He says, I hold, there's some point in the episode, I think it's the second episode, where he says something like, I hold the fate of billions of people in my hand. And so what's, you know, what does it even matter if I eliminate one world from that equation? Like, what does that matter in the grand scheme of things? And to me, that's like, you can't get more core Star Trek than that, right? That's the whole, like, the needs of the many, do the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one type of arguments, which I think are some of the best Star Trek arguments that we talk about. Because, you know, we get our Star Trek II iteration of that, but I think Star Trek over the years has really complexified, is that a word, made more complex that idea. In particular, Star Trek Discovery, I think, has permutated that idea quite a few times in a really successful way. So I love Anorax as a villain. Without going through like all the details of the episode, we go through something like four different timelines. You know, we start in our original one, and then there's three incursions that the Krennan warship does. And so that's kind of fun because you get the universe changing, but Voyager not changing if its shields are up, but then it does change if its shields are down. So there's some fun kind of like pseudo science-y stuff going on there. And like I already said before, this is one of my favorite Janeway episodes. There are so many times that Janeway is just a badass in this episode. You know, it's like Chakotay, there's that time that's like day 65 or something where Chakotay, it's her birthday, May 20th, her birthday. Chakotay gives her a gift, and he's got this great story about the watch that he gives her and how meaningful it is. And immediately she's like, I can't afford to have this. We need to recycle this for resource. Like, she's just always thinking about the next thing, nothing about herself, right? She's always thinking about her crew and kind of how to keep the ship alive. And in the end, we get kind of the, I mean, there's like six or seven different times she's a badass throughout the episode. But then in the end, we kind of knew she was going to be the one to sacrifice herself to get things back to normal, and she does. So I think that shows consistency of her character throughout, and what is this? This is only season three, right? So we haven't completely fleshed out her character. It's season four. Sorry.
Season four.
So, you know, we're 4/7 of the way through the series. So I guess we kind of know who she is at this point. But there are also some great moments between other character pairs, I think. You know, Tom Paris and Chakotay getting sort of stolen away by the Krenim, and they have some great moments together that we could probably dive into if we wanted to. I think Harry Kim and the captain have some cool moments as they're trying to kind of keep the ship together and fix things up. It's this idea of constant peril bringing the best out of people, and Janeway all along being the absolute strongest leader that she can possibly be, sometimes making decisions that, you know, she makes one bad decision that she kind of regrets later, which I think is cool, like showing that she can make mistakes. But overall, there's just so many things for me to like about this episode. So I don't want to take too much away from other people. So I guess I'll leave it there. Something inevitably is going to come up. It's just I'll give this one a 9.5, honestly. When it comes to the only thing that I will say, I'll give it, it's not like all kittens and rainbows. The one thing I'll say is that because the episode sort of ends like so many Star Trek episodes do, where everything's kind of the same at the end, it has that feeling of, oh, it was all just a dream, you know, and that can be kind of annoying, especially when it takes place over 7 seasons on another television show that I won't name right now. But on this particular episode, it didn't bother me for some reason, because we kind of all know they're going to get back to there eventually. Even when it first came out, you know that, like, Year of Hell is not going to be the last episode of the season, because it's 26 episode season. So, you know, there's more to come. So at the end, you know that the Voyager is going to be okay, but I don't think it matters. I think you still go through the journey with all the different characters, and there's value to so many of the interactions we get to see. Okay. I'll be quiet. Pass this on to somebody else.
Well, you're the Voyager guys. And so you take your time and say what you want. I mean, the stage is yours, brother.
Can I ask you about what you said about the ending?
Yeah.
Because I don't think that my take on the ending was that none of that stuff ever happened. I think it seemed to me that it finally, like, they'd found a way of setting things correctly that restored things. But I don't think it was like they never happened. It's just like they were able to kind of circuitously get back to an iteration of reality where things could be accepted again. I mean, it's confusing, but I don't think I don't think they undid all of the stuff that they had gone through.
Well, here's my, I guess
it was more like they found
a
way to like cut back to it or something.
I guess that's true. The only thing is that I will say that in the episode, there's precedent for it having been a never happened scenario, because it's the remember when he first brings Tom and Harry on board the Krenim ship, and they're treated to that big banquet, and he tells them that all of the delicacies in front of them are literally the last remnants of all of these civilizations that, thanks to his timey-wimey-ness, never existed. So it's a little bit of one of these relativity things, right? The Krenim ship is outside of time and space, so relative to them, things happen and then get undone. Relative to the planet who's getting shot and erased from time, it never happened.
So
very interesting.
You know,
very interesting.
I do. So here's first of all, my question would be, when they messed around with time, was it like the Borg coming to Earth? I mean, was it just where they are, or was it like the Guardian of Forever, everything time?
The episode actually answers this too, Jim. That's a great question. And what they talk about in the episode is they talk about the effects of the time changes that the Krenim ship makes have a distance component to them. So in other words, the Voyager becomes an anomaly in their time calculations because the Voyager is 70,000 light years from where they're supposed to be, not because the Voyager exists. And so my take is that, you know, Anorex destroys a planet, it kind of really affects the local space. And then as that time wave kind of goes out, the effects of it are dissipated. And so by the time it gets out in the universe, you know, you and I aren't going to notice any differences to the timeline, even if we had that ability to look at it outside a relative perspective, so to speak, because there's a time component to it. He says that in the episode.
And then when Janeway crashes Voyager into the ship, what causes it to reset to that particular time? Wouldn't it erase all the changes that that ship had done and not just up to that point?
Yes. Well, I don't. Okay. I mean,
destroyed the ship and it takes us right to the beginning of the episode.
Well, we're getting a little bit into the nitty-gritty of, like, how much do you have to explain time travel for it to be cool in Star Trek. But what I'll say is that if I'm to defend it kind of, like, one more time, I'd say that remember at the very beginning of the episode, we learn that Anorax and his ship have already been at this for 200 years. And so may be that when they get destroyed, it may be that all 200 years worth of incursions get undone, but the episode only chooses to show us what happens to the Voyager crew at the end, right? After the Krenim ship gets destroyed, we don't go back and check in on the Krenim Empire again. We just notice that the Voyager's A-okay and ready to go.
Well, we do
so I think all the stuff they did over the past 200 years probably does get undone, tell you the truth.
Interesting.
Well, I mean, we do know that the was it the Krenim, the ship that they run into is still there.
Yeah, it's just that they're So the first ship that they run into in the episode, and then also the last ship that they run into is not Anorax's ship, but is another Krenim ship, and that's another cool component that I think happens throughout the episode is as each one of these time incursions happen, you see the design of the Krenim ships change. Like, it goes from the basic one at the beginning, and then he has an incursion, and he gets to the, whatever, the 98% restoration, but without the restoration of the Kiana Prime colony. And the Krenim ship suddenly kind of morphs into this awesome warship, right? Then it morphs down one more time, and then it morphs down the last time at the end to what they originally saw. But the people are much nicer at the end than they were at the beginning. They're like, hey, at the beginning, they're like, hey, you're in our space. We're going to kill you. And at the end, they're like, hey, you're in our space. We suggest you go around. And instead of Janeway being like, screw you, I'm going anyway, she's like, okay, we'll go around.
Yeah, she's around it. Yep.
So, I mean, a little bit of, like, inconsistency in terms of her reaction to that, you know, scenario. But I think that's a little bit one of the downfalls of Star Trek Voyager. I love the show. I love Janeway. There's so much I love about the show. And also they write her character a little inconsistently and make her decisions a little erratic sometimes. So the fact that in the same episode, she's presented essentially with the same idea, but in one case, somebody's rude about it and she tells them to go screw themselves. And in one part, they're nice. And she's like, no, that's cool. That just is a little weird to me, but that's getting into the extreme nitty gritty of it, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So who wants to go next? Eric?
Well, I don't
Eric
have a ton of stuff to say about it. Just a couple things that's interesting because it's like, I think this comes up when you hear some of the comments that from the fans that Eric read, right? The people wanting more, right? Of this whole thing, right? Well, I don't know how widely known this is. I think it's fairly common knowledge, but the original concept with this episode was this was going to be the entire season, right? This was going to be serialized storytelling, right? And it was going to be like 20 episodes long. And that was originally the whole game plan when they were said, well, no. And they kicked it around, Braga and everybody, and they're like, "Well, no, we're gonna do two. We're gonna do it as a two-parter because they wanted to." There were episodes they had planned where you wouldn't even see Janeway, for part of the time, right? So, I mean, they had some really ambitious plans for this and whatnot, but they ultimately just decided to do, you know, two-parter, but it's a two-parter, I think, that, you know, like you said, is universally considered to be, you know, some of Voyager at its best, for sure. So it holds up really well, and I think one of the reasons, though, it is so spot on and so great is because everybody's under duress, right? And there's a lot of high stakes involved. It's a story about people trying to exert their will against their ability to have acceptance of things, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what makes it so compelling. I mean, Anorax is like, I don't know if you've watched the animated Batman that was done, you know, what, 20 years ago or whatever it would be now, if not longer, but Batman, the animated
the
series.
90s?
Bruce, yeah, like the, yeah. Bruce, the Bruce Timm Batman, right? With Kevin Conroy and whatnot. Mark Hamill is a Joker, but he's very similar to Mr. Freeze on that episode, right? Where his wife is preserved like in glass, right? And she became ill, but he can't let her go. You know, he can't do it. He can't, you know, accept what's happened. He's constantly trying to figure out a way to undo the bad thing that he's kind of responsible for, right? But he can't really accept it, and he can't really move on. He's sort of caught in an emotional version of the time loop that he's creating for the outside world. And it's very poignant, I think. And I think because of the way that character is written and the fact that there are some, you know, really big themes going on here about ability to, like, move on and the way we relate to death and the way we relate to the idea of, I think, very often having resistance to, you know, determined fate or whatnot. I think it's some really strong writing in these two episodes, and we get to see characters going through things that we don't normally see them go through. I think there's some really good character work from everybody, you know, from Jerry Ryan to Tim Russ to Garrett Wong. I mean, across the board, right? And great turns from Janeway, right? But I think what really, for me, the glue that holds together, I'm a big Kurtwood Smith fan. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, ever since RoboCop, right? That guy is just, you know, if he's on, he's on. He just cannot look away. I mean, he is just sensational. And he doesn't make Anorax just a straight villain, right?
Right.
I mean, he's terrifying. He's a really scary guy. And he is a megalomaniac, and he's really hung up on his power, but he's also a man who's desperately heartbroken.
Yep.
Right. And he is the hero of his story from his perspective. And the fact that he made him a really multidimensional character and not just a stock villain, I think, is one of the reasons that this episode resonates so, so, so well for folks. And then what holds up over time, because they really came up with a classic interpretation of that kind of dynamic. And it has a really sweet, kind of bittersweet ending to it, which is really nice. It's like there's some healing and some acceptance and some redemption in that final scene, right? And I think that that sent people away from the episode with a good feeling as well. It's like they went through hell, but they went through all this agita and grief, but there's some acceptance there at the end, and things are kind of set right. And I think that's really lovely and poignant. So for me, one, I think for sure, a great example, I think, of Voyager and Star Trek at its best. I would unreservedly, I would say for Voyager, I would give it a 10, because it's very ambitious and it's got strong writing, and they got a great guest character, and they didn't just lock him into, you know, I'm a bad guy, you know, tropes, right? They humanized him and made him fully realized. So for all those reasons, I think it needs to be paid attention to and emulated for future storytelling. And this is the way you should be doing your writing, right? Is really with care, and it's an epic frickin' story. I mean, it's big, it's epic. There's a ton of action. But it's really human at the heart in the middle. And I think that that's a rare thing. And when that's what I think good storytelling should be remembering to aspire to. So very excited for this. Like, I love that it was suggested. So, yeah, I'm happy to give this a 10.
All right. A 10 it is. How about you? What do you think, Charles?
okay, some of the effect, some of the causes and effects, one of them I think very poignant, is when he mentions the fact that they got rid of a one society and suddenly found out that much of the civilization started dying off because they realized, oh, I killed off society that created the immunity against a specific virus.
Yeah.
That prevented them from dying off in the first place. So
butterfly
it's like
effect.
Yeah. Butterfly effect. You sit there and kill off this one group and guess what? You just killed off that which helped your own society survive.
Yeah, and actually, Charles, if I could just mention, I love that scene that shows that even deeper when Chakotay and Anorax are hanging out. It's in the second episode after Chakotay's kind of like on board with Anorax, and he kind of feels like maybe there's something here that could get the Voyager home. You know, he runs a simulation of destroying a comet or a asteroid or something. And he's like, oh, just destroy the asteroid. And so he erases it from existence. And the simulation results are that, well, that comet's been around for 4 billion years, and it actually dropped the components of life on 8,000 different civilizations that now don't exist thanks to you destroying that comet. So that's just such a cool, like, butterfly effect thing. And when you get into so much of Star Trek, they kind of – for the sake of the story, we'll often ignore those sorts of things. And I love that they had that level of sophistication back in the, you know, 2000, early 2000s with this episode.
Actually not 2000. This was 97.
Oh, is this 97? Okay. Yeah. There
this
you go.
This is 97.
20th
in fact,
century.
We talk about the character development. This was only episode 8 with Scorpio 2 being the beginning of Scorpio. So this was still an early development of 7 of 9.
Mm-hmm.
You definitely had interesting change there because you had a lot of what still a lot of development from 7 of 9 being created there. And then look at all the developments they created in there. The specialized shielding that prevented them from being affected by time. And the torpedoes that got fired off. The chromaton torpedoes. And which reminds me of another episode we've seen of dealing with unique torpedoes. When Cornwell was caught with Delco and having to sacrifice herself to save the ship, in which here Tuvok sort of attempts to do the same thing. 7 of 9 tries to get the calculations of the time differential in there, and this is what causes Tuvok to cause his blindness. Something that kind of hit me with the episode is I agree with some of the fans. I wish they'd gone a little more than just 2 episodes. There are points like, oh, this changed. I didn't realize this had changed. And all of a sudden it's like, okay, we're dealing with Tuvok and now he's blind. It's like, okay, wait a minute. What? Oh, he was blind from that incident. It took me a while to catch up to that. So I would have loved to have seen a little more stretched out so we could have gotten a little more explanations in there. But I'll go with a solid 9 on this one.
Wow, I guess that leaves me as the outlier once again, but I love Star Trek V, so we all have our own opinions, right? And my opinion is completely varied from my 3 Trek experts, but hey, that's what happens, right? We all have our opinions. I was completely bored to death watching episode one. I barely got through it. I was like, oh my God, this is just wow. And I wasn't impressed with part one at all. But I was glad that I continued to watch it, because what you guys mentioned about Anorax in part two, that man can chew up the scenery like there's no tomorrow. And I thought that Red Foreman just pulled it right through, because as soon as we got on the ship with Chakotay and Tom Paris, that's when the episode really, really flourished and took off for me, because watching the conflict between Tom Paris and Chakotay, and Chakotay was kind of drinking the Kool-Aid. He was becoming one of them, and Tom Paris is like, no, dude, this is wrong. And he had to reel Chakotay back. And at one point, I actually thought Chakotay was going to, you know, join hands with Anorax and do this deed. But Paris pulled him back. And I also liked the way the crew on the ship were not blindly following Anorax. I can't remember the guy's name. The first officer that was playing that game with Tom Paris there. Yeah, you know, Tom Paris kind of worked him over. And then you realize that the crew, you know, was starting to think that this is not right. We shouldn't be doing this. And I thought that was, because a lot of times you see these episodes or these movies, and you got the bad guy, and then you got his little cult just blindly following the guy. And how many times you say, wait a minute, don't these people realize that what's going on here is wrong? And in this episode, it was 200 years later, but yes, they did realize that what was going on was wrong. And they
Jim, I don't think the crew wanted to stop him doing it because they thought it was wrong. I think they wanted him to stop doing it because they were tired of doing it. Like they basically say in the episode that they were just tired of constantly trying over and over again and following this person whose intentions seem to be outside of logic. So I don't know that – I want to be careful, because I don't know that they necessarily were against the idea of altering civilizations. They just were tired of following this crazy man who had this want, right? Because they altered, and he kept doing it because he couldn't get his wife back. He got to 98%, and he threw it away because he didn't have his wife back. So
yeah,
it's like Boimler, like having to get from 98 to 100, you know, hit me again.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I thought that was, and I think that making him not be, you know, the mustache twirling bad guy was a great move, you know, because you could see where he was coming from. You could see his motivations and what he was trying to accomplish. And he, you know, I thought that was great myself. And then when Janeway assembles her little band of rebels to attack the Death Star at the end, and Red 5 goes in right in the trench. I enjoyed part two much better than part one, I have to admit. I was getting a little bit bored with the Voyager blowing up and this blowing up and that blowing up. And I'm glad they didn't do it for more than two episodes. I'm glad that they did it for only two myself. I think I would have been bored to death if I had to keep watching a Voyager get destroyed, get blown up, da-da-da-da-da, over and over and over again. I think I would have been real bored at that point. For me, it was enough. So, yeah, I thought that Red Foreman, the guy from RoboCop, for me, he saved this episode. I did enjoy the altercation, though, between the doctor and Janeway when she got the radiation poisoning and he relieved her of duty, and she was like, stick it up your shaft, what are you going to do about it? And the doctor kind of told her he has the final word, and she did it anyways. I kind of like that exchange. I've always liked the holographic doctor. I just thought that was one of the best characters they put on that show, and I really enjoyed him interacting with Janeway in that one scene. So yeah, unfortunately, I cannot in good conscience go with the fans or with you guys and give it a 10. I can't. I can't even give it a 9. So I don't know. I think one of our fans, I think, went with an 8.5. I think that's right about what I would say, about an 8.5 for me. I just couldn't get into the timey-wimey stuff. I'm sorry, guys. I just don't agree. So I'm going to go with an 8.5 for me. So that's my take, and I'm sticking with it. So what's that overall score give us, Charles, as compared to our fans?
Well, with that score, our fans give it a 9.6. The Trek Spirits went down to a 9.25.
Oh, okay. So we're
still respectable.
Yeah, it's still respectable. Still right there. Absolutely.
Glad I gave it a 10.
Yeah, good thing you gave it a 10. So, yeah, that's a year of hell. So, like, if they had made this a full season, you guys already gave it a 10. What would you have seen them do with it that would have made it better than what they did?
Oh, gosh.
We haven't seen those scripts or those stories, but they could have really gone down in different directions. I mean, because they're changing history in basically every interaction, right? Every iteration. So, I mean, there could be, it's like treated as like a volume of short stories and alternate realities.
A what if?
Yeah. I mean, it's a great way of doing storytelling. I mean, all we can do is guess because we haven't seen it. But the idea was to take it and expand it. Right? I mean, you know, it's
I mean, I think you could take any one of these character arcs that we've mentioned that sort of got dipped into over the two-parter, and you could absolutely expand each one of those arcs into an episode. I mean, look at what we get. We get 10 episode seasons now, which are serialized. So we get one story from beginning to end. And in that 10 episode arc, we get, you know, an entire episode dedicated to a single character to develop that character. You know, now we're 4 years into Voyager, so we kind of already know the basic characters, but like Charles was saying, 7 and 9 is fairly new at this point. There's a nice interaction between her and the doctor in this episode where she talks about how she's confused about, you know, why, or not the doctor, sorry, with Tuvok, where she's like, I'm confused about why I would support the captain when I know she's wrong. And Tuvok's like, the captain's always right. And I, you know, that is a concept that I think could have been fleshed out even more. So I don't know. I don't know that it needed 26 episodes, which I think at that time was the standard season. And, you know, maybe that's too much. 26 hours is pretty long for a movie, but you know, we've seen 10-hour movies now that are pretty successful. So could you have done a half dozen episodes on this arc? Absolutely. I think.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. There you have it. There you have it. All right, guys. So that's our discussion. And, so we're going to move on. You know what time it is now? Time for Star Trek birthdays.
That was not a Klingon song.
All right, guys. We always do our Star Trek birthdays, and we start off with, sadly enough, remembering those members of our Star Trek family who are no longer with us. And for that, we turn to Eric.
And Jim, this week we have 5 members of our Star Trek community we're going to be remembering. Born February 23rd, 1932, was Majel Barrett Roddenberry, the first lady of Star Trek, played a reoccurring actress in the Star Trek franchise. Of course, was the wife of Gene Roddenberry from 1969 until his death in 1991. And this association with Roddenberry and his most famous creation earned her that title, First Lady of Star Trek. She's the only performer to have had a role on the first 6 Star Trek series, usually not as a character, but as the voice of the computers on those various series. She also supplied the voice of the Enterprise computer in 5 of the Star Trek films, which is pretty cool, including that Kelvin timeline. Her most frequent portrayal in Star Trek, besides the computer, was that, of course, as Nurse Chapel in the original series and on the animated series and in two of the films. She also voiced Emress and several other characters on the animated series. Later, she, of course, was known as the Betazoid Ambassador Luoxana Troi on The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine. Her first filmed appearance was actually that performance in The Cage that we didn't see until later, but that, of course, was shot in 1964, where she played Number One before Number One even had a name. Also in 1962, Barrett met actress Lucille Ball in an acting class and was signed to a contract with Desilu Studios. Soon thereafter, she appeared with Lucy in an episode of The Lucy Show. I think that if you talk to just about anybody about Major Barrett Roddenberry, you'd say that she's so many of the reasons that Star Trek exists these days. And I personally really, really love her portrayal of Luoxana Troi. Absolutely one of my favorite characters from The Next Generation. She's just delightful. In particular, her interactions with Patrick Stewart as Jean-Luc Picard just cracks me up every time I see her. So one thing that I just found out about her that I didn't know, which I feel like is kind of fun at this point, I didn't realize that in The Menagerie, which of course was that sort of cut-up version of The Cage that we actually saw before we saw The Cage, she was actually credited as M. Lee Hudek. So there you go. Not Major Roddenberry, not Major Barrett, but M. Lee Hudek in The Menagerie. So happy birthday and lots of love and memories and remembrances and stuff going out to Major Barrett Roddenberry. Also having a birthday this week on the 26th, actress Shay Duffin. Shay Duffin, the British actor and playwright who played Ned Quint on The Next Generation 7-season episode Sub Rosa. Duffin regularly portrayed barkeep types, including the pubkeeper in the 1997 blockbuster Titanic and the bartender in the acclaimed 2006 crime film The Departed. He was perhaps best known for his role as Dan O'Grady in the 1993 horror film Leprechaun. Duffin was also known for his one-man plays, including The Importance of Being Irish in the early 1990s, which he also wrote, and Confessions of an Irish Rebel in 2006. He has myriad film credits to his name. You should go check out Shay Duffin's IMDb. We lost him back in 2010 at the age of 79 years old. Happy birthday, Shay. Happy birthday as well to Rhys Vaughan. Rhys Vaughan was the actor who played Lieutenant Latimer in the original series first season episode, The Galileo 7. Rhys also had several guest television appearances on shows such as The Alfred Hitchcock Show, Wagon Train, Virginian, all those westerns from back in the day. He had a little bit of feature film work, including 1965's The Playground, and a couple other ones along the way, one of which featured Joanne Linville, who, if you know that name, then you know her as the Romulan Commander. Rhys Vaughan crossing over with Romulan Commanders along the way. We also lost him back in 2010. Happy birthday. Happy birthday as well to Burt Remsen. Burt Remsen portrayed the Bajoran Kubos Oak in DS9's second season episode, The Collaborator, a fantastic episode. Started his career in the 1959 film Porkchop Hill, which if you haven't seen that, you should probably see that one too. And in just a ton of other really cool movies along the way. In 1964, though, Burt actually suffered a broken back as a result of an onset accident and unable to act any further, became a casting director. Then he returned to acting in the 70s, which to me is just amazing. This man broke his back, pivoted, and then repivoted later on in his career. He crossed over with all sorts of interesting people like René Auberjonois and Sally Kellerman in other movies and things along the way. He was on that 1987 famous season of Dallas. Back in the day, you know which one I'm talking about. So Burt Remsen would have had a birthday just a few days ago, February 25th, born in 1925. We lost him in 1999. Happy birthday, Burt. And last but not least on our list this week, we're saying happy birthday to actor Lawrence Montaigne. Lawrence Montaigne was the actor who played Decius in the TOS first season episode Balance of Terror. He also played that Vulcan Staan in the second season episode Amok Time. According to the making of Star Trek, in the event if Leonard Nimoy had left the series in the second season, Montaigne was on that list of possible replacements. So we could have had him as Mr. Spock. Also, according to Inside Star Trek, The Real Story, Montaigne was the only actor actually considered by the producers for that. So there you go. He's born in Brooklyn, New York. He also, believe it or not, went back and played that role again in the fan film Star Trek of Gods and Men, which if you haven't seen that, that's a 2000 film movie, which I believe also had Walter Koenig in it. It's pretty good. I would definitely check it out. He was also a former United States Marine back in the day. So Lawrence Montaigne, pretty accomplished actor and did a lot of other stuff. Happy birthday, we lost you back in 2017, and we miss you. And that does it for our remembrances this week, guys. So I'm going to pass that flaming birthday candle on to Charles.
Oh, thank you, Eric. Let's start off with a happy birthday to Charles Parks, played Iblan in Star Trek Deep Space Nine, second season episode, The Collaborator. Yeah. Happy birthday, Jocelyn O'Brien, actress who played Mitian Haro in Star Trek Next Generation, third season episode, Allegiance. Happy birthday to Chase Matreson, actress who played Lita in numerous episodes of Star Trek Deep Space Nine during the final five seasons. Also appeared in last season episode of Lower Decks. And is part of the coalition with the coalition's name on the tip of my tongue.
That's the anti-bullying.
Be-kind. Anti-bullying one. So she's very active in that. I think I've seen some pictures of her with the crews promoting that. So happy birthday, Chase. Happy birthday, Joe W. Davis, former actor who played the 25-year-old Spock in Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. Happy birthday, Karen Robinson, actress who played the trail leader, Pav, in Star Trek Discovery's third season episode, Forget Me Not, and All That Hope Is You, Part 2. Happy birthday to Harvey Jason, who played the role of Felix Leach in Star Trek Next Generation, first season episode, The Big Goodbye. Paul, who's on your birthday list?
Thanks, Charles. Well, we got all kinds of good folks on here. I think we got a real exciting one to begin with. I hope folks know who this is, but we don't say a huge, crazy... you have to pick your beer up off the bar and chug it. Happy birthday for Tawny Newsome. Okay. We're talking about Beckett Mariner, right, on Lower Decks. She's made that character so much fun. Actress, comedian, musician. She's been Mariner in not only Lower Decks, but on that outstanding crossover episode on Strange New Worlds, Those Old Scientists, right, where she got to play a live action iteration of the character, which is just wonderful. And from what I understand, she's got a very she's bringing those comedic chops to bear to work on the new upcoming Starfleet Academy series as well, and she's going to be one of the staff writers on that show. So she is a triple threat. Definitely a lot of talent going on there, and a really fun person who loves to, you know, kind of mix it up with the fans and just,
you know,
seems to really enjoy Star Trek.
Paul, she's also got a fan. I just want to interject that she's also got a fantastic podcast, which if you're into this thing, this type of thing, I would absolutely recommend. She does a podcast called Yo, Is This Racist? Where she talks about racial issues and stuff, but with like a comedic kind of twist to it, and it is a fantastic podcast just to get her kind of like no holds barred, no filter take on those sorts of topics. Definitely recommend it.
Excellent. She's got kind of a Key and Peele sense of humor, I
yes
think, is a lot of how I associate her, and very similar kind of bent right? Just very, very just naturally funny and just super high energy. You just know that hanging out with her would be a blast. So happy birthday, Tawny Newsome. I'm sure you're up to all manner of no good on your birthday, and we wouldn't have it any other way. So looking forward to a lot more of you. Please, people with the ability to make decisions, do another live-action crossover on Strange New Worlds. That was amazing. I thought that was such a great episode. Happy birthday also to actress Jameela Jamil, a British actress and television personality, as well as a very staunch activist who we know for playing the role of Essentia on Star Trek Prodigy, or perhaps I should say by her alter ego, the Vindicator, on that show, the Federation-hating Vaunakat character, second only to the Diviner, but a very cool character, very, very fun. She's great and got a definite grudge against the UFP. So I don't know if we'll be seeing more of Essentia or not. One cannot tell these things with the new seasons of Unseen Prodigy so close to coming, but we just may. So happy birthday goes out to Jameela Jamil. Happy birthday also to Australian-born and Canadian actor John Piper Ferguson, who we acknowledge from his Next Gen days when he played Eli Hollander on the sixth season episode of Fistful of Datas, that lovely Western spoof, which was just great. Happy birthday, John Piper Ferguson. Happy birthday also to old school original series actress Alice Rawlings, who played Jamie Finney in the original series first season episode Court Martial. I want to kill you, Captain James T. Kirk, because of what you did to my dad. Hey, it's not so bad. I've gotten over it. I wonder why.
So true.
Jamie, what's wrong? You seem to have changed. Are you okay? I'm okay. I just have big feelings because I'm a teenager. That's nothing unusual. Everything is fine. Don't worry. My dad's not alive. So, yeah, it was great. I mean, it's just an interesting role. But she played great. I thought she was really, really terrific. So very, very cool. Happy birthday also to Makambe Simbamba, Zambian-Canadian actress who played the adult Rukia in the Strange New Worlds first season episode, The Elysian Kingdom. So happy birthday, Makambe. And will we see you on more Strange New Worlds? We cannot yet say. There is still so much of it that we have not seen that is just down the road. We were talking about when will Strange New Worlds come and earlier on the show. And from my guess on that whole thing is Discovery is mapped out to conclude its last season at the very tail end of, well, not so much. Not, let's get an exact date here. It's mapped itself, yeah, very end of May, okay? And my guess is around, like, oh, I don't know, episode 8, episode 9, episode 10, somewhere in early May, Paramount Plus will start releasing promos for the new season of Strange New Worlds because it'll probably slide right on in there after Discovery wraps. My guess is early to mid-June. So we'll see if I'm right, but I would say that is when it's a pretty good time of the year to have some awesome, epic Strange New Worlds. So I think that's when we'll see it, but they like to keep this stuff under wraps until a little closer to unveiling time. So we'll see. And speaking of Strange New Worlds, I'd like to have a big special birthday to a very talented person who's found great success extremely young in life, is Celia Rose Gooding, who we, of course, know has brought such fresh life to the character of Nyota Uvura on Strange New Worlds. What a character actor. What a wonderful performer. She has done Shakespeare in the acting program at Barrage before she really took off and then came to fame winning her role for Jagged Little Pill, on where she got such tremendous acclaim for her work on that. An incredible singer, really, really amazing. She's just got so much talent. Just really, really great. Really unusually cool show on Broadway, at Jagged Little Pill. I don't know if anyone's seen it or not.
But yeah, I've seen it.
She's just great in that as the Frankie character. Really, really, really amazing. And I know that there's – I'm trying to remember what she won. Like, I'm pretty sure she walked away with – not a Tony, but
– it was a Tony. It was Best Featured Actress in a Musical, 2020.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Excellent. God, that's so amazing. I know she won a Grammy, too, for the theater album. That's what I was trying to think of. But but watch, if you've not seen it recently, go back and watch the Subspace Rhapsody episode, the musical episode. I mean, everybody in that episode is great, I think. But, man, Celia Rose Gooding, she just brings those theater chops to bear. She just kicks every kind of ass there is. I mean, she's just got pipes that go all day long. She is just remarkable. So I'm so excited to see her come back on Strange New Worlds, along with that whole cast on that show. I think everybody on that show does a remarkable job. It's a real, it's an ensemble show, right? I mean, and Mount's gracious. He doesn't try to hog the limelight, right? And become like, it's the captain's show. Not at all. He lets everybody shine, makes sure it feels like a family, like an ensemble, makes plenty of room for Kirk, gives him his chance to grow. It's just great. So what a wonderful show, and I'm super looking forward to more. And so have a well-deserved happy birthday, Celia Rose Gooding. We salute you. Passing it over to Klingon-loving Uncle Jim.
Well, we're going to continue the love for Strange New Worlds because the man himself, my man crush, yes, that's right, the man himself, Captain Christopher Pike, Anson Mount. We want to say happy birthday to Anson Mount, who plays Captain Pike in the second season of Star Trek Discovery. So a lot of people that passed on Discovery, what are you waiting for, man? Go back and watch season two. It's awesome. We get to see Spock. We get to see Captain Pike. We get to see Una. Check out season two of Star Trek Discovery. But wait, there's more. He also appeared in three episodes of Star Trek Short Treks, which I really miss and wish they would bring back, because Short Treks gave us, you know, these little 10, 12-minute snippets around some of these characters, and I would love to see them do that some more. So he did that. And he happens to be, believe it or not, the fourth actor to portray Pike. So happy birthday to Anson Mount. And I should mention that he also was in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. A lot of people don't realize that. He played Black Bolt. Yep, he did. He played Black Bolt. He died really quick, but he played Black Bolt. And he was also in Hell on Wheels with Miles O'Brien himself, Cole Meany. So happy birthday to Anson Mount, the man, the myth, the legend. Next on my list, we want to say happy birthday to Stephanie Beecham, the British actor who played Regina Bartholomew in Star Trek The Next Generation 6th season episode, Ship in a Bottle. Me personally, I know her as Dr. Kristen Westphalen from the first season of DSV. Sequest, which I thought was a great show, and I really missed that show a lot. They twisted it and tortured it, but she was in the first season, which I think is the best season. So happy birthday to Stephanie Beecham. And now we move on to the Klingons, because I always save the Klingons for last, and I've got two. First, we want to say happy birthday and kapla to James Worthy, the former professional basketball player. Here is Quora, the TNG 7th Gambit Part 2, standing at 6 feet 9 inches tall. Worthy is the tallest ever Klingon seen on screen. So happy birthday to James Worthy. And finally, last but definitely not least on my list, I think that this guy might be more well known for the Romulans that he played. But he did play a Klingon, so that's how I'm going to remember him. We want to say happy birthday to James Sloan, who played Admiral Jarek in the Defector episode of TNG. What an episode, huh, guys?
So
that
good.
That took the cake right there. I just when the Enterprise is there with the Romulan warbirds and then the Klingons decloak behind them.
So badass.
It's just incredible way to end that episode. And Jarek was just was an awesome character. So, but he also played Maura Paul in the DS9 fifth season episode, The Alternate and the Begotten. And he appeared as May Boral in the Voyager episode Jetrol. I think it's Jetrol. But I'm going to remember him playing Alexander from the future in the episode Firstborn. He named himself Kimtar, but he was actually Alexander coming back in time to steer his younger self into being a Klingon warrior so that his father wouldn't die in the future. So he played Kimtar. So that, my friends, wraps up all of our Star Trek birthdays. A lot of fun doing the Star Trek birthdays. It's fun to go back and remember some of these characters and some of these episodes and have some fun with it. So that wraps up our birthdays. Now it's time for Star Trek news.
Priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Incoming transmission.
Enter authorization code.
Command codes verified.
Define parameters of program.
Level 9 authorization required.
Specify parameters.
Transfer of data is complete.
Black alert. Black alert.
All right, Eric, you want to get us started with our Star Trek news this week?
You bet. This is our Shatner section, but it's not really a Shatner Says What this week. At 92, William Shatner shines with VES Award for Creative Excellence amid a lifetime of stellar achievements. The room was charged with anticipation and respect as William Shatner, a name synonymous with pioneering spirit both on screen and off, stepped onto the stage at the Beverly Hilton. At 92, with the poise of a seasoned star Voyager, Shatner accepted the VES Award for Creative Excellence. His presence was a testament to a career that has not only traversed galaxies in the fictional realm of Star Trek, but has also left an indelible mark on the real world of entertainment and beyond. Shatner's contributions to the entertainment industry extend far beyond his iconic role as Captain Kirk. As the mission control director on Fox's Stars on Mars and the voice of Teldor in of the Universe Revolution, he continues to work and inspire. His upcoming comedy, Keeper of the Cup, alongside Jason Priestley and Dan Aykroyd, humorously explores the lengths to which Toronto Maple Leafs fans will go to claim the Stanley Cup. His forthcoming documentary, You Can Call Me Bill, aims to bridge generations, offering a glimpse into the man behind the legend with a poignant focus on connecting with his grandchildren posthumously. The introspection into morality and legacy offers a rare, intimate look at Shatner's life beyond the camera and the starship helm. As the evening concluded, the significance of Shatner's award resonated beyond the confines of the Beverly Hilton. It was a celebration of a man whose career has been defined by exploration, innovation, and a relentless pursuit of the unknown. In receiving the VES Award for Creative Excellence, William Shatner was not only being honored for his past contributions, but was being celebrated as an enduring inspiration for future generations of storytellers, creators, and dreamers. Congratulations, Shatner. I think that's a kind of a cool award. It's sort of honoring him for being, an icon, not necessarily for his like individual achievements, but for how he took that role and sort of elevated it and how he's kind of exhibited that in some of his other things throughout his career. So I don't know. Congratulations. I think that's pretty cool and kind of a neat award for him to win at this point. And it's nice to know that he's still working, he's doing voiceovers. He's doing all kinds of cool stuff. I'm kind of interested in seeing You Can Call Me Bill, just because I want to know what that's going to look like. So,
well, Eric, I'm going to bring up a comment on that. That is coming to theaters, but they're doing an interesting way of doing it. They're actually asking people to go to the website and pay for their ticket early, so we can get theaters to reserve, see how much interest there is in the country and reserve theaters to actually show the movie. And then if your city doesn't get it, then they'll refund your ticket price.
Oh, my. Well, you know, that's not strictly true, because Bill has some overdue money problems. He's trying to get them to buy the theater early so he can pay them off. That's really as simple as his bills have come due. He's not a very shrewd businessman. Well.
Well, but if people are interested in seeing it, get your tickets early so that you've got a better chance of your city getting it, and maybe more than one theater.
Cool. Thanks, Charles.
And there's some special pins, too, for advanced purchases. So.
Nope. Special perks.
Yep.
Cool, man. Great. Well, I'm going to pass the newsreel, over to Jim, who's going to talk about.
For David.
What'd you say? What'd you say?
Who wants to take over for David?
Oh, we can do this one.
Who,
do you want
to? I put in for David because I figured you guys play this game, but David's not here, so either Charles or Paul can jump in on this one.
Well, I guess I'll have to jump into it since I'm playing some of this already. New Dune, Star Trek, and Conan projects are announced by Gale Force 9. The first of these projects is The Adventure of Conan, which marks the first time Gale Force 9 has published a Conan tabletop game. Players take the role of either Conan or one of his allies or foes as they work towards different objectives. While Conan and his allies can work together, the foes can hinder Conan by laying traps or throwing obstacles in Conan's path. Each type of character in the game comes with their own custom dice, which dictates which action a player can take during their turn. Gale Force 9 is also publishing a definitive edition of its popular Star Trek Ascendancy, Final Frontier, which includes every existing expansion for the game, plus new material that adds another new faction, new ships, and new planets for the game. Gameplay involves players vying for control of the galaxy, exploring new planets, playing star bases, and pushing to add more planets under their respective banner. Finally, project is Dune.
Kuzak's Hatterack.
The new version is the classic Dune board game. Originally published in 1970s, Gale Force 9 re-releases Dune board game for a new generation. The game won several awards and received several expansions, all of which will be included in the new edition. Also included is new content adding additional factions to the game, including luxury components for playing. I personally am a fan of Ascendancy, having the original game and several of the expansions. I've also been playing their Star Trek Away missions. Got to be an OP, winning Q in that one. And waiting for my pre-order of the new TOS characters in the expansion. And I wish they'd expand by putting another ship down there. If we're getting TOS characters, how about the old Enterprise, not the new Enterprise? And I want to see
Charles,
what they do with some of their sets.
How exactly does Q work into the game? Is he a playable character?
Q can come onto the board as a playable character. I only got through two missions of four. Q also kind of messes with people because he has his own deck of tricks. And sometimes he'll sit there and say, oh, if you're near Q, then you'll get bonuses for attack, but then you're going to lose bonuses for trying to do a specific task. So he's kind of there to mess with what you're doing and maybe giving you some advantages. I think later on he's got some cards in there that really will mess with your characters.
Yeah, I think Q in Star Trek Away Missions is meant to be played as part of special scenarios, Jim. He's not a character that you'd necessarily like throw on your team if you were just going 1v1 with somebody and not playing one of those special scenarios.
Okay, all right. So you still play the Klingons or the Romulans or
yes.
the Feds.
Yeah, yeah. And I will exactly. say that, like, in terms of this article, I think this idea of releasing Ascendancy with all of the expansions is kind of cool. I mean, I'm like Charles. I've been sort of collecting them along the way, and I think I've got all but maybe one or two of them. But if you're going to jump into the game, this would be a great way to do it. And Star Trek Ascendancy is a fantastic game that I love
yes.
playing. It takes a little while. It's probably an hour and a half per person, depending on your
yeah.
level of. But the other thing is that this game from the 70s, the re-release of the Dune board game, is kind of exciting to me because the Dune board game that they put out in the 90s was terrible. But the one from the 70s was pretty good, but it was impossible to find forever without paying hundreds and hundreds of dollars for it. So I love that there's going to be a new option for that, and probably it'll be rebalanced and updated and all that sort of stuff. So I think that's cool.
Yeah, Ascendancy Final Frontier that is going to have all the expansions.
I mean, that's a lot. It's going to be an expensive game because there's a ton of expansions for it right
yes.
now, and there's at least...
One, two...
Yeah. There's like eight
five,
expansions or seven or,
no,
I don't know, a ton. There's so many. I mean, you got to count the Borg and the Dominion and the Cardassians. And anyway, there's
the,
a lot.
The Andorians and the Vulcans. And then there's
yeah, and the Ferengi.
The new ones,
and, yeah, there's a whole bunch. The Breen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, that'll be expensive.
Anyway. Yeah, it'll be very expensive, but you'll get it all in one shot, and it sounds like it comes with cool components, too, so I'm all about it.
Yeah, because what's the regular game run? About $100?
The regular game's $100, and the expansions are between $30 and $50, depending on which one you get and how many components it has. So it's not, you know, it's kind of the going rate for complex board games these days. You can't really find a really cool board game for about, you know, less than about $50 at least. And Ascendancy has so many pieces, and the quality is
yeah.
really good too. It's all like really cool cast plastic pieces, really good quality cardboard, really good quality cards. So it's worth the $100 for sure.
And if you've got a group of Star Trek friends and you want a game where you're not, oh, I don't want to play a game that's going to last me an hour or two. If you want a few hours and coming down to seeing who can really strategize, it's worth it for that. It is one of the better strategy games out there.
Oh, excellent. I'll have to keep an eye out for it. Star Trek Ascendancy, Final Frontier. And I've got the last story here of the night. Star Trek's secret weapon for making fans feel spotlighted. Showrunner Mike McMahon credits the show's musical star and composer Chris Westlake as the reason why audiences feel so strongly for Mariner, Boimler, and the rest of the USS Cerritos crew. I think a lot of the reason people feel on Lower Decks is because of Chris Westlake's music. Quote, "We really bring it with the music department." He once told me, "Not to switch to Star Wars, but Chris is the only guy I knew who can do that John Williams does. And I think an episode of Lower Decks has almost as much music as a season of Discovery in terms of how many cues." Like, is very crazy, but Chris once said that the reason people like The Force is because of John Williams. Because without John Williams' music, it's just a guy holding his hand up. But when the score comes in, you start to feel something. And that's Chris's job on Lower Decks. I'm in charge of making people laugh, and he's in charge of making people feel. And then Tawny and Jack and Eugene and Noah, they're all right in the middle of all that. So at any time you're feeling something on Lower Decks, really listen to the music. That's our secret weapon. Star Trek on Paramount Plus shows features a powerhouse lineup of composers. Jeff Russo has been scoring Star Trek Discovery since season one, and also provided the score for Star Trek Picard season one and two, before Stephen Barton and Frederick Wiederman took over and added odes to the Star Trek music, movies, and Star Trek Picard Season 3. Mami Melman is Star Trek's first female composer, and her scintillating music enhances Star Trek's Strange New Worlds, Star Trek Prodigy, while Jeff Russo and Michael Giacchino respectively provide those shows' main title themes. And Chris Wieslick brings heart and feeling to even the most absurd Star Trek Lower Decks scenarios. Music has always been Star Trek's secret weapon, going back to the theme of Star Trek the Original Series, composed by Alexander Courage. When Star Trek jumped to feature films, Jerry Goldsmith composed an epic score that later became the main title theme for Star Trek The Next Generation. James Horner's score for Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, remains a classic and is crucial to the emotion of Spock's Leonard Nimoy's sacrifice and death. Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Star Trek Voyager, and Star Trek Enterprise were scored by Dennis McCarthy and Jerry Goldsmith, among others, and music is part of the fabric of those series' success. Musical scores hammer home the emotions of Star Trek's characters and connects them to viewers at home, whether in live-action Star Trek or animated series like Prodigy or Lower Decks, which Mike McMahon understands to his and the audience's benefit. I couldn't agree more. I think that music definitely... I said this when we were talking about The Mandalorian in Season 1. You guys recall way back then. Music. You got to stimulate what's between the ears. If you get your brain stimulated, you can hear a song and it will pull you right into whatever emotion the composer wants you to feel. And I think Jerry Goldsmith in particular, especially with that awesome award-winning score for Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, probably one of the best. Right?
I can't disagree with the fact that he's an amazing composer. And yeah, the music work in Star Trek V is actually really good too. I will say that I think that one of the reasons that music is so important is that it connects to a more emotional piece of the human kind of experience, I think. So much in the same way, you know, smells might remind you of something nostalgically from 20, 30, 40 years ago, I think music kind of does the same sort of thing. And one thing that Star Trek composers have been able to do recently is they've been able to kind of use the formulas that allow them to access melodies or other kind of familiar aspects of previous soundtracks and then kind of drop those in as little hints here and there. I think about the Picard theme in particular, you know, bringing the flute into it or that type of thing. I think there's a level of sophistication to composing scores these days that is above and beyond what was there before. And I think it's because of people like Jerry Goldsmith who raised the bar, right? And then somebody's like, oh my God, okay, I got to at least meet that bar or people aren't going to pay any attention to me. And, you know, I don't know if I could say people are his equal, but man, some of the new music, including Rousseau's stuff and all that stuff, it's pretty high quality these days. And it absolutely pulls you along with all of the sound editing and that kind of stuff right into the story.
Well, let me ask you, when you watch Star Trek, the motion picture and you hear Jerry Goldsmith's V'ger theme, and the cloud is lighting up, do you get the impression when you watch that that's V'ger talking and not
music?
Is that V'ger communicating? Yeah. I watch it, I get the impression that the sounds that we're hearing is V'ger communicating. That's what it comes across as to me.
You know what I think, Jim, is that I think that three or four people could interpret that three or four different ways and they'd all be right. I think probably the intention was to set a mood and to kind of like, you know, form the mist around the scene that's going to happen. I don't know if it's literally supposed to be V'ger talking, but it kind of reads that way, right? I mean, it's very mechanistic. It uses that great technology of the late 70s of those keyboard pads that have a cool like delayed reverb that sort of echoes out from that. I mean, it's a very there's a point in time when music sounded like that, and the late 70s and early 80s had a lot of that stuff. So to me, it's, you know, maybe not literally Beeger talking, but it's clear that when that music happens, you're supposed to know that Beeger's on the screen or Beeger's coming or something.
Yeah, I think the soundtrack, it reminds me of the soundtrack for 2001, A Space Odyssey. You know, it's a classic score.
Well, I mean, that one in particular uses classical music in a very interesting way, right? Like, that, like, not all of the music that is in 2001 was composed for 2001.
Right. But it's so identified with the movie.
Totally.
You know, that it's incredible. And the Klingon theme, you know. Is Paul having some technical difficulty here?
Sounds like Paul's trying to interject, but his mic is not working. So we'll make sure and open it up for him if he turns it off and turns it back on again and gets it working, though. Because I'd love to hear what he has to say.
Particularly like the Klingon theme from Star Trek, the motion picture, they have carried that theme through Star Trek from day one. You know, the
Klingons amazing.
Have that.
Well, there he is.
There he is. We got him.
Sorry, guys. Something happened with my mic there, but I just wanted to chime in on the music thing because you made such a good point, Jim. It's like when it's really working really well, it's like it's somehow channeling your unconscious or your subconscious, right? I mean, well, maybe in my case, my unconscious, but it's like it's providing a whole nother emotional subtext to a scene that the dialogue and the images alone can never do. It helps bring your emotions and lets them engage with it. So it's such a powerful part of storytelling.
I agree. Music can make, or I've said this when I went to see Top Gun Maverick, and I know that it's, you know, 30 some odd years later, and there's a whole new brand of musicians working on the movie, but when the movie started on the aircraft carrier with Kenny Loggins, Danger Zone, I was in the movie right away. I mean, right away, my brain went right back to the, and there I was. And music can pull you right into a situation right off the bat. And just like a bad score can pull you out of it too. It can go both ways. But when it's done right, it's incredible. It works so well.
Well, and Jim, I will say that Star Trek's not only got great composers and stuff, but they've taken some risks with soundtracks, right? Like, you know, using the Beastie Boys in the Kelvin timeline movies or, you know, things like that. They've taken some risks, and there's not a ton of people who are still Star Trek fans who say, nah, the music sucks. I think everybody pretty much universally is on board with what they're doing.
Yeah, because I think in this article they cited John Williams, but I think a lot of people overlook Jerry Goldsmith. I mean, what has the man not done? Planet of the Apes, Logan's Run, Alien, Star Trek. This guy knew how to do it, and he did it well. So I happen to agree with this article 100%. Music. And like when we were watching Picard season 3, did you not hear every little music cue that brought you to, you know, Wrath of Khan, Search for Spock? They were all in there. They were sprinkled throughout there, you know, and it only takes a couple notes. Your brain will hear it and you will know. Like I can name that tune in three notes. And all you got to do is hear those three notes and you're right there. So, yeah, I hope they keep it up. Well, guys, that pretty much wraps up our show for this week. Can you believe it? We got through it without David.
How about that?
So next week, we're going to be talking about Sela, the Romulan commander Sela, played by Tasha Yar. What is she up to these days? Where's she been?
Played by Nadese Crosby, not played by Tasha Yar. Yeah.
Well, you know, Tasha Yar was her mother. You know,
live the dream, so, Jim. Just go all in.
So we'll be talking about.
We're here to celebrate Captain Kirk in his new role.
Well, and I think it's important to mention that we're going to talk about Sela, not just in the context of, like, the episodes that she's been in and how she connects to Tasha Yar, but there is a most excellent annual copy of the Defiant comic out right now where the story focuses on Sela. So we're actually going to explore some on-screen stuff, and we're going to explore some comic stuff in the same show. One of our first kind of mixes, Comic Corner plus regular show.
That will be interesting. We haven't done a Comic Corner in a long time. We're like really, really behind on our comics.
Yeah, but it's a great mix thing. We'll never catch up on all the comics that we've missed in terms of reviewing them all, but this one is kind of, I think it's going to be unique because it's going to bring in Alpha and Beta Canon on a really cool character.
Yeah, for sure. So you guys will definitely want to tune in next week. And we have a treat for you guys, too, because we're going to be talking about those nasty tribbles are getting into everything again. We're going to have a very special show coming up, not next following week. The man who wrote The Trouble with Tribbles, and I think, did he write the animated episode, More Trouble, More Tribbles as well? I don't know.
I believe he did.
I have to do some research on that. What about the Deep Space Nine episode?
That's Trials and Tribulations. Yeah. Oh, Trials and Tribulations. Oh, yeah.
Trials and
Tribulations.
I don't know. Yeah.
We'll have to find out.
I'll have to do some research and find out. But I had reached out to him quite a while ago because...
it was written by him. The animated series episode was written by David Gerald.
Oh, excellent. Okay. And I think, if I remember my Star Trek history correctly, I think he's written a bunch of Star Trek books, has he not? I think, like, The World of Star Trek. I think he's written a lot of Star Trek books, quite a few. And he's going to be on the show to share. And if I remember correctly, now I'm reaching way, way back, but I think he may have been in Star Trek The Motion Picture as well. I remember seeing a picture of him standing with Gene Roddenberry in a Star Trek The Motion Picture jumpsuit. So he goes way back in the world of Star Trek. And we'll see just what kind of stories he wants to share with us. And you guys will be able to call and ask him questions as well. So that's going to be, what, the 14th? I don't have my calendar in front of me. But what's the date of that show?
That's next week, so that's actually the 7th.
Okay. So, you guys definitely don't want to miss.
Sorry, I forgot that we're in. It is the 7th. Yeah. Yeah, 7th.
Well,
if
next week is Sela, is it the week after that?
Oh, sorry, week after is the 14th. You're right, Paul. Yeah, sorry. Next week is Sela. The 14th is David.
So it's not there. That's not the same episode, right? We're doing.
Nope.
Those are two different episodes.
Yep, sorry.
All right. So, so the 7th is Sela and the 14th. Yeah, it'll be the 14th.
Yep.
So you guys definitely want to check that out. It's going to be. Who knows what he's going to talk about? He's been around Star Trek since Star Trek was Star Trek. So I'm sure he's got a lot of great stories to share with us. All right, guys. Well, that finishes up the show. So I want to say thank you to Paul for hanging out and Trek talking with us tonight. Thank you so much, Paul.
A pleasure, man. We always have fun on this thing. It's great.
You never know where it's going to go, do you? It just meanders and meanders. And of course, we want to say thank you to Eric as well for hanging out and Trek talking with us. Thank you, Eric.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, guys.
And thank you so much to Charles for hanging out and Trek talking with us as well. Thank you, Charles. Okay. And we hope that David is having a very happy anniversary tonight. So happy anniversary to David. Have lots and lots of donuts. And I'm your most excellent host, Uncle Jim, saying hailing frequencies are closed. And everybody, please be good. And stay safe. Star Trek fans are the best fans. Good night, everybody.
Good night, all. Take care.
Night, all.
Let's see what's out there. Engage.
Reach the Q Continuum. We are unable to get to the phone right now because we are busy living in a plane of existence your feeble mortal minds cannot possibly comprehend. Furthermore, it's pointless to leave a message because we, of course, already knew that you would call, and we simply do not care. Have a nice day.